scores! Gilmore scores! With 1:03 left.
Off the glass, to left corner to Aguilla. Aguilla to the left circle. Passing to Yell, a shot. Save made by all. Aguilla's rebound. Another shot. They score! The Flames win it! Yeah, baby!
They score!
And the sea of red erupts.
Flames talk starts now on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Here's Pat Steinberg.
Okay, let's get things going on this Tuesday. It is May 6th, and we are underway on Flames Talk. Welcome to our Groundworks downtown studio. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Seeker, or wherever you get your podcasts, and live right here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Lots to get to from around the NHL and some Flames news over the weekend, and we're going to dive in on all of it with our NHL insider Frank Saravalli to kick off this hour. Frank, brought to you by South Trail Chrysler, where they always make the buying process simple. Look for the big Canadian flag at 130th Ave or visit SouthTrailChrysler.com. And Frank joins us now from Daily Faceoff, Amazon, and a whole lot more as we chat with Frank every Tuesday here on Flames Talk. Mr. Saravalli, how are you?
Pretty good. How you doing, Pat?
I'm doing well. Curious, and we'll get into all the playoff news, all of what we saw on Monday night, look ahead, and lots to dive into around the NHL, but curious what your reaction was to that seven-year contract extension the Flames and Matt Coronato agreed to over the weekend.
I thought a really interesting bet from both sides. This is a player who obviously had a pretty explosive year, who had taken a pretty big stride forward, that if you're in the mission or if your mandate is to score more goals, locking up a guy that has his potential right out of entry-level deal and gaining some cost certainty is a really – you can never go wrong with a move like that. I mean, he's so close to touching 50 points and – really a huge part of this core moving forward. And the other factor is, which the Flames were definitely not shy to point out, he really wanted to be there.
Yep.
And that's a huge part of the puzzle, is when you have someone who is from the East Coast in the U.S. and they say, I want to play for the Calgary Flames, you do, and he's a fit, you do what you can.
Yep.
And the reason I mentioned it was a bet is because right now, like in this exact moment in time, like it's still an overpay for Matt Coronato. It is. But they have a potential and possibility here to make this a real value deal in short order. Like, I'm thinking that from a Flames perspective, you're probably thinking first year overpay, second year break even, and the last 5 years, let's roll the dice and see what happens.
Yep.
And from his perspective, the same thing exists. Like, yeah, I'm getting a little coin and security in my pocket and a pretty big, you know, career arc crowning achievement for anyone to get that kind of financial security. But the risk on his end is that he's very underpaid for a significant chunk of this contract. And that's where you end up having two sides meet in a deal.
Yep. You know, there's interesting candidates on every team every year to take that potential risk and decide to go long-term. I mean, here in Calgary, Dustin Wolf, we talked about him last week. There's Kevin Ball and Connor Zeri, which are interesting candidates as well. But it's like the long-term contract is not a one-size-fit-all for guys coming out of entry level, is it? Like, there are different factors, and it doesn't make sense for every guy.
Well, I was actually going to say, there's probably every team in the league that tries, that wants to try and dangle a deal like that, that you've got agents that are really just too experienced and too smart. And I'm not saying in this case that I believe it's John Azetutu that is Matt Coronato's agent. Not suggesting at all that he, you know, this is a massive home run for him and his client, like, to get a deal of this magnitude, for sure. But there's a lot of agents out there that would advise their player, no, take a bridge deal and let's make them pay later. And it's really about trying to convince you. You've got to find that sweet spot.
Got to find the right deal number, where. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's so many teams that dangle that long-term deal that just, it's not really that enticing to players because they're not offering enough in the short term to really make you think twice.
Yeah. Yeah, I was, you know, when, as we were, because it was one of those contracts that I think the Flames were interested in going this direction right from the get-go. And it was all about finding that number. And it was kind of like, okay, does 50 in and around $50 million, and it ends up being 45 and a half on a 7-year deal. Like, is that enough to convince the Coronado camp? And, you know, when you've got a guy who expresses that he wants to be here, you know, you got to find that sweet spot number. And I know that some of the comparables out there and, you know, some of the numbers of the Coronado camp might have been looking at, whether it's Slafkovský or Boldy or Gunther or even Dylan Cousins. All those guys had multiple NHL seasons under their belt. The area where the Coronado camp maybe didn't have the leverage was the fact that he only had the one full season of NHL time under his belt, which helped the Flames in this case, right?
Well, no, I was going to say, to me, it actually heightens the risk for the Flames. What happens if this year was, I'm not saying it is, but like, what happens if it was one moment in time and next year he comes out and he has 42 points?
Right.
18 goals, 42 points, then what?
See,
That's why I believe authentically there is a real risk for both sides. That's otherwise you wouldn't arrive at a deal.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't.
Agreed. And yet, I kind of feel like it's a good bet. As much as there's risk on both sides, I also use the word bet. I think it's also a really good bet on both sides because if you're the Flames, you believe that with this kid's work ethic and his shot and his hockey IQ, that the offense just grows. And from a player standpoint, this deal expires at 29. And so you're in a situation where, you know, you've got an opportunity for another.
You've bought all of the very best years of Matt Coronado's career, more than likely.
And yet you also have another opportunity at a 4, 5, or 6-year deal afterwards at 29. So you kind of set yourself up, in my eyes, for kind of, I don't know, 12 or 13 pretty decent earning years.
You've put yourself in a position where you've guaranteed yourself $45.5 million with the money he's already earned in his career that'll put him north of 46. And you will have put yourself in a position with the cap going up and those other year earning years from 29 to 34, call it a ballpark, to maybe be a $70 million player.
Yeah.
Last time I checked, it's pretty good work if you can get it.
Any of the other, I mean, Wolf feels like there's a real debate between bridge and long-term, like a real debate from especially his camp side, like, do we go long-term right away or does it make more sense to go bridge? And that's the most interesting one now when it comes to who might be the next big-time term deal for the Flames.
I agree. I wonder about Zeri, though, if there's a time to pounce now, though.
Yeah, that one's it's tough because of the injuries, right? And it's tough.
Right.
Like you've got
but
the leverage on the Flames side.
That's why I think there's a vulnerability. If you're the Flames, if you could maybe potentially exploit that a little bit and say, hey, there's no guarantee that you know, your knees cooperate and that you're going to be this player. What if we offered you 6-year? I'm just totally pulling this, out of the thin blue sky. What if we offered you 6 times 4.5?
Yeah. So that's what? That's $28 million, $27 million?
That'll take you to 29. Put some serious life-changing coin in your pocket.
Yeah.
Some real significant upside for the Flames. And if you're the Flames, you just buy an insurance policy on whatever the health issues are.
Now, if you're the agent, are you advising your client even more to go bridge in the situation with Zeri?
No, I would be advising my client to take the deal.
Because what happens if you get one more
injury on your bridge deal? And he was honestly really able to skirt, by the grace of God, something way more significant.
When twice.
A couple of them looked pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
What happens if you take the bridge deal and you get, let's call it 2x4? Okay, so you take the, it might not even be that high, 2x3.5.
Mm-hmm.
And you get hurt. Then what?
Yeah.
You could self-insure. You could buy a policy yourself to cover against future earnings. But wouldn't you just be better off taking the guaranteed cash and say, you know what, I can live with it if I am underpaid, because that means that I've had a successful career and I de-risk my future by earning all this money. I just think that's a real window into conversations that players and agents have repeatedly.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating time with some of Calgary's young players right now. Anything else Flames-wise before we move on to some of the league-wide stuff? Anything else you got your eye on from a Flames perspective?
I mean, just the constant discourse that seems to have gone to another volume with Rasmus Anderson. It's kind of been fascinating to watch, to be honest.
In what sense?
Well, I just, the conversation publicly seems to be misaligned with what I think the Flames might actually be feeling or thinking.
In that the conversation publicly seems to lean more towards moving him?
It seems that it's been pretty, like, and I'm just, again, just from what I see, read, hear, scroll through, it seems that there's this foregone conclusion that Rasmus Anderson's played his last game as a Flame. And I'm not saying that he hasn't. I'm just saying I don't think it's nearly as cut and dried as that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's going to either take the absolute right deal between now and July 1st for them to not get there. And then I think it's going to take some time, because I think that they need to know whether or not, again, I keep going to the two kind of poles when it comes to Rasmus Anderson. There's the Jacob Chychrun deal at 8x9, mm-hmm. and there's the Neil Pionk deal at 6x7. And you can guess which deal each side would gravitate towards. But, you know, if the Flames could get something closer to the Neil Pionk deal, I still think they'd be very interested in signing Rasmus. You know, are they ready to go 8x9? I'm less confident in that, but are they in the range of 6x7 something? I could see that still happening. So I'm not as convinced myself. Like, if you were to ask me, I still think this does end in a trade when it's all said and done, but doesn't have to happen this summer. And B, I still think that there is a non-negligible chance that he does extend with Calgary.
Look, I'm just going to say this because you said it, and I just want to seize on it for a second. I think they're absolutely dreaming in Technicolor if they think that Rasmus Anderson is a $9 million a year defenseman.
Yep.
Jacob Chychrun is a 20-goal scorer as a defenseman.
And a year and a half younger.
A year and a half younger, and an 18-goal season in a 56-game season.
Yep.
And I don't know. I think there's many other facets to his game, and obviously different players, because Anderson brings a whole total other physical component that that Jacob Chychrun doesn't necessarily have, but I just think that's a significant disparity. I know there's an ice time disparity. I just think he's probably a lot closer to Pionk than he is. And I would also make the argument, by the way, that said, that Pionk took a hometown discount.
Yeah, I agree. I agree on that front. I think he probably could have gotten, especially on the AAV side, I think he might have been able to get a little bit more if he did decide to go the UFA route.
Just my two cents.
He's Frank Saravalli. It's Flames Talk on a Tuesday. Frank joins us every Tuesday here on Sportsnet 960, The Fan on Flames Talk, wherever you get your podcasts, and live right here on Sportsnet 960. What did you, Frank, as we transition, it's funny. The Flames went into that second draw, and they were still on the board. They still had a 9% chance, one number away from moving up 10 spots on the second lottery draw, which I think the whole thing caught a lot of people off guard. Like, oh, hold on a second. It was a lot of fun to watch. What did you make of the first ever live drawing? You've been in the room before, but it's never been televised for all of us to see. So you've been on the inside of this draft lottery, and then you saw the actual presentation on Monday night. What did you make of all of that went into it?
I've been advocating for years to just have them do exactly what they did last night. And part of the reason for that is having been in the room and paging through the thousand ball combinations, you realize doing it just how close teams are that you otherwise never would have thought about and otherwise wouldn't, it would never be talked about. And so when you're flipping the cards as they used to do, not that that's necessarily a bad way of doing it, because there's certainly an element of suspense of taking the card out of the envelope and flipping it over and definitely, you know, dramatic and theatrical, but it kind of, at that point, as you're whittling down the draft order, it takes away from the other teams that could be in the mix. And when you see 7, 8, 9 teams still have a chance to win that number one overall pick on the final ball, that is like, that's what TV should be all about.
Yeah.
And that's when you're actually in the room and you can cross off combinations if you can do it fast enough. It's like, it's an adrenaline rush. And so it's pretty awesome to see that play out. And I enjoyed it. I think the complex nature of how the NHL does it in terms of having multiple draws makes people's brains explode. I just don't know what the alternative would be to fix that or dumb it down.
Yeah, I thought it set a really good template going forward. And, you know, could they could probably do a little bit of a, like an explainer right off the top or something like that. Like, this is what exactly is going to happen. One draw, then we're going to talk to the winning GM, another draw. And that would be the only thing that I think you could add to it. But on otherwise, I just thought like the live probabilities and the holy bleep, my team's still in it. And then like when they were crossing off the teams, you're like, geez, San Jose's not going to get the first overall pick or likely not going to. I thought that part was just pure theater, and they've never done it. Like they've been able to like keep you in suspense before, but we all knew that they knew. So we knew it was artificial suspense. Whereas this was, everybody didn't know this was real suspense. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I'm with you. And let's see what it goes to next year when we've got way better. Not to knock on Matthew Shaver or Michael Mesa or anyone else, but it's the 2025 draft is not the 2026 draft. I'll say that.
Islanders in Utah, though, the big winners each move up 10 spots to 1 and 4. What is Monday's lottery mean to the New York Islanders and Utah Hockey Club?
Well, it makes the Islanders' job that much more attractive. Not that it wasn't already, but if you can add another difference maker by sheer happenstance, you've got some positional boxes checked already, Sorokin, Dobson up front with Barzal. If you can add a top pair defenseman who's 18 to that mix, I just think you've got another really important building block. And for Utah, it's kind of like an embarrassment of riches. Like they've already got arguably one of the deepest prospect pools. They've got draft picks out the yin yang, and now they've got optionality. You could trade out of that fourth spot if you're not a believer in the player you might be able to select. You could to get a better roster player right now. If you wanted to trade other prospects in your pipeline or other draft picks because you know you've got a quality selection coming your way, you could do that. I believe wholeheartedly that there is no team better positioned for future success in the NHL than Utah Hockey Club.
You love that. You love that prospect group, don't you?
I just think they've got dynamic star players. They're really kind of missing a goalie, but that one line that Cooley's on is like, is legit. Like they're fast, they're skilled. They may not have a ton of size, but then you look on the back end and like Sergachev has plenty. And I just think they're not a perfect team, and they could definitely use more size, but I think a lot of their building blocks are in place to be really successful.
Frank, what did you make of the Sam Bennett collision with Anthony Stolarz on Monday in Game 1 between the Maple Leafs and Panthers? And I guess on top of that, the decision for no supplemental discipline.
Definitely understand how they arrived at no supplemental discipline. I mean, we see that play or something similar to it pretty frequently. That said, I think anyone that thinks that Sam Bennett didn't know exactly what he was doing is absolutely kidding themselves. The contact, some have called it the lack of force. All of those things that factor into it. Was it a hockey play? Yes. I think there's two separate things here. One of those is, do you understand why it's not a suspension? And my answer is yes. And then my next question would be, do you think it should be a suspension? And I think a couple things. One, I don't know how much we're talking about it. If Stolarz maybe didn't sustain a concussion previously on that shot from earlier in the game,
yep.
Like how much did this forearm to the head exacerbate that? And two, if he's not injured, like, would we ever talk about this play again? And the answer is probably no. But do I think in the end that goalies should be more protected than they were in that sequence? My answer is yes.
Yep. Okay. Two more for you. First of all, Edmonton, Winnipeg. How are you feeling about both teams heading into round two?
I think they're both were exposed a little bit in round one. I think if the Oilers think that they're going to be able to get away with gift wrapping goals, that they're going to be in big, big trouble because there's not going to be a comeback. There's not going to be the same margin for error as there was against LA, against Vegas. And I think at the same time, Edmonton has a really interesting potential advantage on depth at the forward position, given the way that Kane played and Trent Frederick, when healthy, really contributed to that series as it went on, that they might be able to exploit some of Vegas. Dorofeev, what's his status moving forward? Is he out? Assuming he's out. Can the Vegas top line get going that really struggled in the first part of that series? In the end, I think this series is a coin flip. I've got the Golden Knights in six, and I think Vegas just plays a more clean, more successful brand of hockey than the Oilers do at this moment in time. But again, it's very close.
And last one for you. You know, we had those two incredible game sevens over the weekend, and obviously we just talked about Winnipeg, and they exercised a demon with that win over St. Louis, and truly incredible when it's all said and done. You know, when we talked last week, your point was, boy, this Avalanche team feels like they're heading towards a major missed opportunity. Then they win game six, and they force game seven, and they've got a 2-0 lead after 40 minutes of play in game seven. Where are we on the Avalanche after that epic collapse on their end?
We're at a team that's at a really interesting crossroads. I mean, they've traded one of the true game breakers in the league as they were torched by in game seven.
Yep.
They tried to add more. Yeah, 11 points in the final three games of the series is crazy. They tried to balance their team out for some more depth. They appeared to make the decision that they weren't willing to pay three players, 12 to 13 plus million, and probably ends up Makar being around 15 on his next deal. All really fascinating decisions, and also trading your best prospect for a guy in Brock Nelson who didn't really contribute and may walk for nothing in the end. I think they've got lots of questions to answer about their construction moving forward, but I think the one part lost on everyone else, it seems, is that there seems to be less questions asked about the guys in the room. As Nathan MacKinnon skates off to the Worlds, you guys had a 2-0 lead and choked it away in the third period. You had the ability in game two to step on Dallas's throats, and you didn't. Mm-hmm. And you came back to Dallas for game five after dominating them in game four in Denver, and you didn't show up. So we could talk about the really aggressive changeover and turnover in Denver this year, but we should also probably ask some questions of the guys that are there to say, like, where were you, Kel Makar and Nathan MacKinnon, when it mattered most?
Yep. Thank you, Frank. Great stuff as always, my friend. Appreciate the insight. We'll do it again on Tuesday of next week. Have a great rest of your week, my friend. Thank you, pal.
You too. See you, Pat.
He's Frank Saravalli. He is our NHL insider, Daily Faceoff, dailyfaceoff.com, and more. He joins us on Tuesdays here on Flames Talk, and he joins us brought to you by South Trail Chrysler, where they always make the buying process simple. Look for the big Canadian flag at 130th Ave or visit southtrailchrysler.com.
Flames Talk is on the air and streaming on the Sportsnet mobile app. Sportsnet 960 The Fan, Calgary.
Steinberg and Wes Gilbertson along with you on this Tuesday edition of Flames Talk. Hi, Wes.
Hey, buddy.
How are we doing?
Oh, we're doing good. How about yourself?
I'm doing well.
Yeah?
Lots there to dive into from the Frank conversation. Frank joined us to kick off the hour. Some good stuff on the Coronado and Zeri stuff, which we will get into a little bit more in the second hour of Tuesday's show. Lots to dive into, though, around the hockey world. Okay, where are you on Sam Bennett and that play? So, the former fourth overall selection, 18-year-old Sam Bennett, as he was known here.
No longer 18.
I don't believe he's 18 anymore. But for the every time he did anything in his first couple of years, it was 18-year-old Sam Bennett or 19-year-old Sam Bennett. It's like, we sure do know his age. I don't know how old he is now. I think he's like 29. But he, of course, runs into Anthony Stolar's little chicken wingish elbow. But in the midst of making a hockey play, I know there are many in the Toronto market who believe that Sam Bennett is that type of player and thus did that on purpose and knew exactly what he was doing. I know that there are others who are not in the Toronto market who are like, no, there's nothing to see here. Now, Sam Bennett definitely knows what he's doing, and I fully believe he knew what he was doing, and yet I'm kind of with you. I was not expecting a suspension on this Tuesday morning, that's for sure.
I described it in a conversation I had with someone earlier as my assessment of it was that it was a one-minute minor. Like, it's a play that you absolutely could have.
That's right. Glenn Gulletson always used to call them 1-minute penalties.
Yeah. Like, you could have you could have penalized that on the ice, and I wouldn't have argued against it. You know, in fact, I'd probably skew on the side of protecting goalies, and so, you know, any sort of rub around the crease area, I've no problem with them calling that as a minor. I think where a certain area code has lost me is on the calls for suspension. You know, maybe we should take Sam Bennett's skates away and never let him play in the NHL again because of how malicious this was. And I just didn't see it this way. Yeah, Sam Bennett is not shying away from contact there. He's looking to rub the goalie in the crease, and I have zero problem with that being a minor penalty. I just think when it's not a minor penalty on the ice, this call for a suspension, and obviously whenever you see someone physically ill the way Anthony Stolarz was last night, I never want to see that, right? You never want to see a guy who potentially has a head injury so severe that that is the result of it. And yet I just think if you boil it down to that very little play, I didn't see enough there for supplemental discipline. And I'd be cautious of what, you know, when you start tying supplemental discipline to what the sort of outcome is injury wise, you open another can of worms. Well,
and the other thing is it's also difficult. Look, do I believe Sam Bennett meant to do what he did? Honestly, yes,
absolutely.
That's always who he's been, like, but sneaky greasy,
but it's just a rub. Like, there's no big flying elbow start the lawnmower action there.
Agreed. And it was sneaky and greasy, but also one of those plays that you can't assume that he was trying to hurt the guy. As much as past history impacts clear suspensions, like when Rafi Torres was throwing dirtbag head hits after dirtbag head hits, it became easier to jack the suspension higher each and every time, but his hits were never borderline, and his hits never even came close to straddling that tightrope. Instead, he just jumped right over the tightrope and, you know, with 2 feet in and a couple of machetes, right? So whereas Sam Bennett is one of the best in the game of playing hard and walking the line, and we can all say we think that he intended to make head contact, you can't suspend based on we think he thought.
Yeah.
Which is where I think we are.
Well, and I think, and again, I can't stress enough, you know, I hate to see the injury. Anthony Stolarz has been one of the best stories in the NHL this year. I hope he doesn't miss any time. You know, I was on the golf course last week and somebody says, oh, well, Toronto's good in goal, they have Stolarz. And I said to them, imagine saying that a year ago. Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, the Maple Leafs no longer have to worry about their goaltending because they have Anthony Stolarz. But he's been this terrific story this year. Certainly played really good hockey in the first round. And so you hate to see the injury, but if there wasn't an injury, and obviously there's a secondary debate there in terms of what damage was done on the hit and what damage was done on the shot off the mask earlier in the game. If we weren't talking about an injury, nobody is replaying that Sam Bennett rub in the crease. I bet if you could go look at Twitter from the time it happened, nobody is saying, oh my God, Sam Bennett has to pay for this. And so you almost go from, this could have been a good example of Sam Bennett staying on the right side of the line. And again, I would have had no problem with it being called a minor penalty on the ice. I really struggle with escalating it past that. I like the way Frank put it. I understand why there's no supplemental discipline there.
As I was thinking about it, remember there was a time when, especially in this market, but I think this is a league-wide thing, but in this market, there was a time when clearly Vancouver was the most detestable team on the planet, when Alex Burrows and Maxime Lapierre and Kevin Bieksa and that group all played in Vancouver.
There's no doubt right now.
And then I forgot the most important name of all, Ryan Kesler. And then both Kesler and Bieksa moved to Anaheim to join Corey Perry. And so it very clearly became Anaheim as the number one most hated team. But league-wide, like when you're talking about Bennett, who is like a saint compared to the other two, 19 and 63. But you've got Sam Bennett, who is as sneaky dirty. And I don't even say that in like a, I love Sam Bennett. I love the way he plays. And it's so cool to see how he's flourished. But like, he plays on the line. And Matthew Tkachuk is, well, we know who Matthew is. And Brad Marchand just happens to be in Florida. Like, there's no question where all the rats are now. Just happens to be the same place they throw rats on the ice.
Last night, the game ended, and we still had the TV on at home, and all the, you know, all the post-game questions are about, okay, what's up with Stolarz? What did you think of the hit? You know, I got a bit of a chuckle out of Matthew Nyes saying, well, I didn't see the hit, but I hope that the league takes care of it. I have no idea what happened, but they have to suspend them. Anyways, last night we're sort of, you know, the post game's on the TV, and my much better half said to me, imagine going into this game telling someone that of all the players on that team, or even on that line, everyone was going to be the most mad at Sam Bennett tonight.
Very true.
Because Matthew Tkachuk, and I'm actually surprised there hasn't been a little more blowback in Toronto about this. Matthew Tkachuk went after his old junior buddy Mitch Marner pretty hard at the final buzzer there last night.
Did he ever?
Nobody seems to be mentioning it.
Game two is going to be outstanding.
Yeah, and I certainly understand the uproar in Toronto. They're in tough against the Stanley Cup champs.
Hey, look, if that happened in Edmonton, if that was, I don't know, Mark Stone's one of those guys who walks the line, although I generally like to think that he's a pretty clean player. But, you know, Mark Stone plays so hard at all times. He's always putting himself, like that hit that he laid in the game in Calgary at the end of the year there.
Sure, or if Trent Frederick did that to Aiden Hill tonight.
Or you know, if the Flames were playing against Winnipeg and, I don't know, Scheifele did that against Dustin Wall, the conversation would be the same. Of course, it is magnified because it's Toronto in round two and they're one of eight teams still playing and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're like, I think this would have been the same in any market, but it's true that it has taken on a rather loud and large voice in the last 12 to 16 hours.
Yeah. And it's going to make for an even more fun series. You know, you heard me say yesterday, it's the one I'm most excited to watch anyways. The spice level in this Toronto-Florida series just got ratcheted up. I know that Craig Berube is adamant that back in his day, and I did watch the highlights of that Ducks brawl the other night just to reminisce. But
the Ducks-Flames brawl?
Yeah, where Dave Lowry
suspended or fined or whatever
it was. Yeah, where Dave Lowry flipped it out over the glass with less than a minute left so Berube would get back on the ice, and then he chased around Jeff Friesen.
Yeah.
You remember that one? Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I'm not sure, and I understand the posturing that comes after any incident like this. You know, Craig Berube's insinuation that somebody would have taken a pound of flesh immediately after if this was back in the day. It seemed like a nothing play until what happened to Anthony Stolarz. Totally nothing play to
me.
Not a clear as day elbow, as Craig Berube would lead you to believe. There was certainly contact there, but this was not the malicious incident, at least through my eyes, that some are making it out
to. No, and if that was Alexander Barkov, I don't think we're having this conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
But because
if it was Sam,
has Barkov won a Lady Bing? I think he has. He definitely has won Selkies, and he's one of the best players on the planet. And he's not—that's not how he plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if that incidental contact happens with him, or I don't know, like,
but don't
Carter Verhaeghe or something, I don't think we're having the same conversation. But because Sam Bennett has the reputation that he does, because Toronto and Florida have played in the playoffs in recent memory, because Sam Bennett has crossed the line many times in the postseason over the last number of years, and sometimes to his own team's detriment with his penchant for taking silly, ill-timed penalties, which still exists even though he's not wearing a Flames uniform anymore.
He took another silly one in the third last night, didn't he? Yeah.
That's why I think the uproar is what it is.
But let me ask you this. If it was, you know, you use Barkov as an example, or let's say it was Sam Reinhart, as long as there was an injury there to Stolarz, don't you think there's still an uproar today?
Yeah, I just think that it's less of the screaming bloody murder because it's not one of the public. If that's Marchand, Bennett, or Tkachuk, this is the uproar. Sure. I think it's a little bit more muted and people are losing their minds and calling for retribution and, you know, all of what has gone into this if it's a different player. But because it's one of the big three that you love to hate in Florida,
right?
That's also part of why it's taken on the life that it has.
I mean, it helps that anyone who wants to make a compilation video at home can Google Sam Bennett dirty and a few clips come up, right? You're going to have to dig a little bit harder for evidence that Alexander Barkov is a dirty player. Yep. And you can go find clips on all of them, but yeah, Sam Bennett has a reputation and he's earned it and he's proud of it.
Yep.
And it bubbles up in incidents like this.
I mean, I'll tell you what, that was Martin Pospisil on Connor Hellebuck in round one. You know what the conversation would be around the league.
Probably can't even walk down Main Street in his hometown of Holland Landing today.
See? Sam would have a hard time walking. Just stay in the hotel. Okay, here's some of the text response at 960-960. Kevin in Evanston says, in the NHL, they always talk about headshots and the principal point of contact being the head, which is exactly what Bennett did. So not sure why this shouldn't be a suspension because the main target was the head. The force should not be a factor in the decision. Bennett may have just shifted the momentum in the series because I'd be willing to bet Stolarz is done for the series. I'm going to read a few of these. Because there's a few on the same theme. This says, you don't need to know intentions. He hit Stolarz in the head and Stolarz left the game. That comes from Matt and Cochran. Ken says, I thought head contact, regardless of intention, was a suspension. Here's the problem. That's not entirely accurate in that head contact is still allowed because the understanding in the NHL is you're playing a very fast physical game, and so sometimes guys' heads are going to get hit. It's when they are targeted and when it is very clear that a player went and targeted with the principal point of contact, and this one is so gray area that I think it's really hard, especially, and whether you think this should be the case or not, but especially in the playoffs, that's really hard to determine that he targeted the head and that wasn't just incidental contact. An incidental head contact is not something that you get suspensions for, and thus you can't, beyond a shadow of a doubt, in a second-round playoff series, tell me that was clearly targeted intentional head contact. That's the problem.
Yeah,
because you could very easily, if you slap my face or Shan's face or Wes's face on Sam Bennett and that play ends up happening, you can very easily make the argument that's just a hockey play with incidental contact at the edge of the crease with a guy making a strong hockey move trying to score a goal.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Listen, one of the reasons that playoff hockey is so fun to watch is because of the size of the gray area, right? It's a pretty intense and, you know, it can be a bit of a violent sport to watch. And it's why we love watching it. And when I say violent, I don't mean guys trying to concuss each other. It's just a lot happening at high speed and a lot of collisions and all that. And I just think when you slow the tape down to 1/20th of its speed, it's a little easier to look and say, oh my God, he was trying to hurt him there. And I just don't know that argument can be strong enough in this case, for supplemental discipline.
Dave says, the goal is to hit and hurt as much as possible without getting a penalty. Bennett, done. Check mark. Dylan says, not suspendable, but definitely could be a penalty. And finally, this says, what if that same play was done to Wolf, which I think we covered already.
Let me ask you this. And you know, I said earlier, similar to what Dylan just said, if there was a minor penalty on the play, if it was flagged as something illegal at the time, does it change the conversation today?
Not really, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't really think so either.
Because the player left.
Yeah. The player...
It's very similar, different plays, but very similar. And I guess kind of very similar situations with the hit on Scheifele by Braden Schenn. And I think Braden Schenn is a far less borderline player than Sam Bennett is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Braden Schenn belted Mark Scheifele. Maybe that's the hit that hurt him. Maybe that's not the hit that hurt him. Winnipeg Jets fans were screaming bloody murder, as were the Jets, as to how did he only get a 2-minute penalty. It didn't matter. The Jets won the game anyway. It didn't matter in terms of the outcome of the game, I mean. Jets won that game anyway. He clearly wasn't going to get a suspension. So what are we talking about the next day was kind of my point.
Sure.
That's kind of where we are in this one.
Well, and
Leafs won the game. Whether he got a penalty or not doesn't change Stolarz' fate, rather. And they likely weren't going to suspend.
Well, and you raise an interesting point, I think, with the Scheifele hit, because there was some debate post-game about, well, what was he hurt on? You know, Jim Montgomery said, I think he was hurt on this play. And Scott Arneal basically said, mind your own business. He was, you know.
Where's your medical degree?
Yeah, he was hurt on this play. But now here we all have our medical degrees out. You know, Anthony Stolarz was struck in the head more than once last night. And I think that has complicated as we all try to determine what caused the injury.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, nobody except for Anthony can tell us the answer to that question, but it further complicates this conversation.
Quickly, before we wrap up this hour, just very, very quickly.
How quickly?
Ish.
Okay.
Oilers Golden Knights.
Series or tonight?
Series.
Oh.
I think Edmonton's competitive, but I really feel that against a team like Vegas.
Yeah.
With no Ekholm and the Calvin Pickard story, mwah, great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's still Calvin Pickard.
Yeah.
Oilers will win a couple games in this series, but yeah. I think I've got Vegas. I really do feel like Vegas is a team that wraps this up in a hard fought but convincing 6-game series.
You know, it pains me to say this, but I like the way Edmonton was playing so much at the end of that series against the Kings. That if you gave me $100 and asked me to bet, I'd have to go Oilers.
Wow. Okay. Shan is not happy about that.
I picked Oilers too.
Did you really?
I did.
Wow.
It's okay. Unfortunate.
I feel vindicated over here.
Can I change mine?
Just because of Shan? What about Winnipeg, Dallas? That starts on Wednesday.
Yeah.
I have very 2011 Canucks vibes with what we just witnessed in Winnipeg.
Okay.
A team that has been so good for so long, has been finishing in good spots and making the playoffs, and been one of those teams that is ready to take a step. Ever since they got to the Western Conference Final in 2018,
yeah.
They haven't been able to do much at all. And I look at this team with that goaltender who has been absolutely hounded by he can't do it in the playoffs, and he was getting hounded with that after, what, 58 minutes on Sunday night? Like, everybody was ready to sharpen those hellebuck daggers and say, this guy cannot win in the playoffs. And then he puts on a shutout performance in two overtime periods almost, and he was spectacular in that first overtime period. It feels like, you know, the playoff Connor Hellebuck moniker maybe has been bucked off the shoulders, and we'll see what the Morrissey and Scheifele situations are like and whether they're ready to play on Wednesday night. But boy, it feels like Jim Houston. It's a great day for an exorcism. It's a wonderful day for an exorcism. It feels like what happened in Game 7 for Winnipeg. I don't know. I got a lot of vibes of Game 7 for Vancouver against Chicago, where they slayed a dragon in Binnington and the Blues. They got out of round one. They had to do it in holy crap fashion. And I feel like Winnipeg is rolling and feeling it. They have run into a buzzsaw that's getting Jason Robertson back. And Dallas is a hell of a hockey team. I think that's Winnipeg in 7 is where I'm leaning.
We might have to make some friendly wagers, because I'm going with what I feel, and I love the Jets story, and I am about to start this answer by admitting how crazy it is that I just threw my faith behind Pickard and now I'm going to bet against Hellebuck. I'll take the sure thing, which is a Dallas team that's getting warmed up, is getting Robertson back now, and will eventually, I think, have Heiskanen in their lineup. And while I think what happened on Sunday helps Hellebuck get over his playoff struggles, I think a couple bad goals and
brings it right back.
That narrative is back. I mean, that Snuggerud goal short post was the worst goal of the opening round by so far that I'm sorry, Ken Weeb, if you're listening, but I just can't put my faith in the Jets against the Stars. I'll go Stars in, I wouldn't go more than six.
Okay. And finally, some Flames prospect news that we just wanted to touch on briefly.
Yeah.
Luke Misa, we know where he's playing next year, and it won't be the Ontario Hockey League. So there's another member of the 2024 draft class going the college route next year. Henry Muse off to Michigan, and Luke Misa heading south the border next year as well.
Yeah, to Penn State, and Eric Jameson as well, another defense prospect like Muse committed to Denver a
That's
while
right.
ago.
That's right. That was about like 3 months ago.
Yeah, quite a
Jameson
while ago. But
converted to Denver.
I think this
had a hell of a year, too. Like, one of the more sleeper, like, late round pick for the Flames. But boy, did Jameson have a good sleeper season this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Playing a lot with Landon Dupont, actually, as his defense partner. I think the Misa, I haven't talked to anyone with the Flames about Luke Misa committing to Penn State, but I imagine they were doing cartwheels at the Saddle Dome. Fifth round pick. 85 points, I believe, in the OHL this season. A guy with offensive upside, for sure, who needs to get stronger. And so playing weekends and working out all week at Penn State, I think, is going to be really good for Luke Misa. This guy probably watches more Andrew Mangiapane film than anyone ever. They think, the Flames, that is, think that there could be a lot of Mangiapane in that package, that he has to have that sort of relentless determination on pucks, and then he might be able to chart a similar course. Penn State, I think, a really interesting fit for a year or whatever it happens to be.
And Andrew Bacha, I don't know if Medicine Hat needs other players. What is Gavin McKenna at? Almost 3 points a game in the playoffs. They could be
absurd.
Getting some just incredibly absurd.
Yeah.
What Gavin McKenna. I always understand why they come up with fun turns of phrases, you know, what it was, slacking for Macklin or
right,
lose for Hughes or whatever it is. What Gavin McKenna is doing right now in the Western League playoffs is stupid.
Absolutely
I digress.
Crazy, yeah.
Teammate Andrew Bacha, second round pick of the Flames, product, might be knocking on the door for a return as well.
Yeah, practice today. He's been skating at the Saddle Dome for a long time. I actually think he was skating with Michael Backlund for a while as Backlund prepared to go to Worlds. And so Andrew Bacha, if you're wondering why you haven't heard more about him, he had, and I can't remember if it was December or so, but he had ankle surgery.
Yep.
And the idea of the ankle surgery was to make sure that his off-season training wouldn't be compromised. Like, if you keep playing through this injury and we wait and do the surgery in April, you're not going to have the big summer we need. So he was sort of jeopardizing what could be his or should be his final junior season. Kind of becomes a best of both. The Tigers are in the WHL final. Good chance to go to the Memorial Cup, and it sure seems like Bash is going to play a few games before it's all done.
Steinberg and Wes from our Groundworks downtown studio, your local experts for foundation and crawl space repair.